This is Fresh Air. My guest, Simon Chama, is the author of a history of the French Revolution called Citizens. It was called a revisionist history, both in praise and criticism. Chama is acutely aware that historians can never be certain they are accurately reconstructing the past. That gap between events as they occurred and as they are later retold by historians is the subject of his new novel, Dead Certainties. There are interlocking historical stories, each told from several conflicting perspectives. One story is about James Wolfe, the British general who defeated the French in Quebec in 1759. I wanted to know what interested Chama in telling the general's story and in using that story as the point of departure to discuss larger questions about how history is written.
The major thing for me there was the issue of historical invention. I remembered as a kid, it seems incredibly embarrassing now, but when I was a child, the year of Queen Elizabeth II's coronation, we all read books with titles like Our Empire Story, in which impossibly white people did amazingly heroic things against unspeakable odds. Wolfe was one of them. And one went with those books in one's hand into a place like Westminster Abbey and looked at Wolfe's tomb, and one was exposed to a kind of historical inevitability. The empire had to be this way. The hero had to die in a position of enormous sacrifice, almost a martyrdom. And I was giving a course, actually, at Harvard on the British Empire, and someone said to me, you know, there are some of Wolfe's letters in the library. And I went to look at them. And the first thing I noticed was, instead of a powerfully self-motivated heroic script, these little kind of spidery, frail, tortured hand, and what the hero spoke about was not the destiny of the British Empire, but headaches, the way his bowels performed. He was a mess. And really, that story is about the process of invention, of myth and fiction making, to the point where it congeals into an inevitable chronicle of power.
Well, you know, two of the ways you tell the story of Wolfe's death. One way is through the eyes of a soldier who is in the middle of a miserable battle, and he sees West dying with kind of ooze dripping from
Wolfe
him.
Wolfe dying.
And it's a kind of like lonely, ugly murder. But then you look at the Benjamin West painting from 1770, 11 years after the general's death. And this is, why don't you describe the painting?
Well, the painting really is an icon. It's it's exactly organized like a deposition of Christ. We have the body of the general clothed in his correct contemporary uniform of the 1750s, something which created a great scandal since he wasn't Christ, nor was he a Roman hero. But his kind of body is sort of being gently folded to the ground, and he's attended by an enormous crowd of onlookers, just as the deposition of the cross was. They are mourning. One figure is actually has his hands in a position of prayer, and as a silent figure of a noble Indian seen in profile, done very idealistically, who is a kind of mute witness to this crucial historical moment. Now, West was a young American making his way inside difficult, rather crusty, snobbish British society, who decides to produce this extraordinary spectacle. It was a production number in exactly that sense. And it comes off. Everybody faints away with rapture, and they think about the historical event as West paints it. He has really painted the event into history, and there it really remains for 200 years. And you're right, what I was trying to do in this way, a bit like, you know, the Japanese film Rashomon, is give alternative voices, alternative witnesses, including ordinary soldier, kind of stumbles onto the event, and whose voice is the opposite, who's very laconic, whereas West's voice, done into paint, is a huge, great piece of rhetoric.
Will you quote the painter Benjamin West in describing why he wanted this heroic depiction of the general's death? And he says, Wolfe must not die like a common soldier under a bush. To move the mind, there should be a spectacle presented to raise and warm the mind, and all should be proportioned to the highest idea conceived of the hero. A mere matter of fact will never produce the effect. Do you think that this is typical of the distortion that happens when art tries to represent history? Or is it just typical of a certain kind of art?
Well, it is typical of a certain kind of art, but one which has had tremendous power. If you look at the history of art, the history of classicism is intended to represent edifying moments. And what was shocking, or what was really brilliantly inventive about West's Death of Wolfe, was that instead of having somebody from remote antiquity in this position of exemplary sacrifice, it was someone really quite recent. It was just a recent event and done in modern dress, and it triggered off a huge controversy. There is a sort of general issue, I suppose, not just in painting, Terry, but in sort of history writing, that historians, I think, inevitably, and for very obvious reasons, tend to focus in on events to which they assign huge significance, so that very often they too, while not being quite so scandalously idealizing as the young American Benjamin West, tend to foreground heroes and perhaps villains. If you think of Bob Caro's biography of Lyndon Johnson, something I admire a lot, in something people said, I think, quite correctly about the last volume, was the villain and the hero were very starkly represented, almost as though they were part of a Greek drama. So I suppose while I don't want to condescend to that view at all, but I did want to sort of try and perform out a messier, more complicated, more banal, more cacophonous version, really, of the historical process.
Are there places during your life as a historian where you felt guilty of over-embroidering historical narrative to bring out a more heroic, symbolic quality in the story?
Well, I think, one's possibly going to say the book on the French Revolution, but the French Revolution, all the actors in that are so correctly self-conscious that they're living at a time of kind of terrifying drama, which their own private lives are at risk. It's very difficult to exaggerate, the intense and tragic quality of that event. I did write a book in my callow youth many, many years ago, which embarrassingly enough, I think is going to be reprinted in paperback next year. The first book I ever wrote was about actually the collapse of Holland at the time of the French Revolution. There, I think probably I did assign tremendously kind of poetic qualities to this experience, where people were really simply struggling for a crust of bread and trying to literally, in some cases, absolutely literally prevent the dikes from bursting over them. So I think maybe the younger you are, actually, the more tempted you are by poetic exaggeration and melodrama.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Simon Shama. He's a professor of history at Harvard, and his best-known book is Citizens, A Chronicle of the French Revolution. Now, his new book is a historical novel called Dead Certainties. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Historian Simon Shama is my guest. I want to get back to the Benjamin West painting of General Wolfe. In the way it heroicized Wolfe and Wolfe's death, and in the way it distorted the truth to make it seem more heroic, would you make a comparison to, say, contemporary miniseries? I'm not saying that artistically they're on the same level, but we're all the time exposed now to historical novels and historical miniseries that always take certain liberties with the fact just to make it a little more dramatic. Mm. But does that kind of stuff bug you a lot?
Well, I guess, I'm not against historical miniseries on principle, but I'm always, this is going to get me in a lot of trouble, because I said, oh yes, limey, do it better. I always think they could be done so much better. I, in common with, 13 million others, was sort of bowled over by, Ken and Rick Burns' incredible series on the Civil War, which seemed to me to, foreground heroes and tragic figures. But because it really slowed down, it took time, and it had a wonderful kind of tempo, which came from reading letters and all those very extraordinary view of photographs. That did the job perfectly. It presented the memory of an event with all the kind of, tragic power of which it was capable. It's when, in fact, miniseries are in a tremendous hurry to get Gregory Peck on the screen as Lincoln, and do the Gettysburg Address and drown it in really slightly ghastly sort of Andrew Lloyd Webber thereabouts music, that it just really, this is sort of Hollywood putting on clothes. There was a lamentable miniseries on Napoleon, where it seemed to me most time had been spent on judging the depth of Jackie Bissett's neckline, as Josephine. You could see the rumpling of the hair, and the stories are so exciting and so dramatic and so extraordinary that I'm sort of always wanting them to be done much better.
Since your book is in part about what you describe as the slipperiness of historical fact, I'm wondering about the difference between how you were taught the American Revolution growing up in England and how you could
see... We tried to forget about the entire unfortunate event.
Because now you're a history professor, usually based in the United States at Harvard.
You know, I tell you the book I remember as a kid, which did slide over that with great genius, a book that I think none of my colleagues will own up ever to having read. That's Winston Churchill's History of the English-Speaking Peoples. There, George III is presented more or less correctly as an impossible fathead. And there were certain heroes who, with gloomy expressions, saw it coming, like William Pitt the Elder. And the House of Commons, dominated by the king and other fatheads, goes tottering to predictable defeat. But of course, Winston Churchill's mum was an American. He adored America, and he sort of thought of himself partly as a kind of Atlantic figure. So somehow for him, it came out all right in the end. Nonetheless, even with this relatively jolly view of the transatlantic partnership, I couldn't help feeling that at the very least the great British Empire had stubbed its toe very painfully. So one was taught to sort of, you know, hurry up over this and get on with the Battle of Waterloo, and everything came out all right all over again. Then there was the 19th century and Napoleon's nose rubbed in the mud of Belgium. That was okay.
So how were you taught the revolution in school?
Well, we were taught it was that it was actually an avoidable mistake, I think. It was interesting. We would, you know, we didn't read the first lines of the Declaration of Independence. You know, the crucial word, first word of that is when. I mean, there's when in the course of assumes that at a certain point a society becomes so mature that it cannot simply be bullied, patronized, and made to pay taxes it can't see any reason to pay for. We were taught that, no, it was a kind of family quarrel. It was a sort of house divided, that it could have been patched up, that even as we speak, New York City could be like Toronto, peopled with loyal Scots and part of the great family of the Commonwealth. It's absolutely ridiculous, really. We certainly weren't taught about it as a bloody, difficult war, which was brilliantly exploited by the French and which in some sense was an inevitable separation. But remember, I was taught that in the aftermath of the last war, when British children like me were absolutely conscious that the war might have turned out very differently hadn't it not been for Franklin Roosevelt.
You're a history professor at Harvard. Mm-hmm. What makes you uncomfortable about academia? What don't you like about it?
Well, the immense sort of, I mean, the sense in which the, you know, a word which does really send my spirit sinking to my boots is the phrase, the historical profession. One goes to huge conventions and conferences where thousands of historians just talk to other thousands of historians, and they do so not just out of a sense of ritual, but the sort of sense that really a profession, you know, it's rather like engineering or the law or something, should develop its own private forms of language. And it is really a kind of mystique will separate you from the general reader. I mean, obviously, those historians with whom I feel closest kinship are historians very often who've written before there was such a thing as the historical profession. I mean, I'm not presuming to compare myself with, you know, Macaulay or Parkman or such like, but, you know, sort of men and women of letters, really, sort of people for whom the storytelling aspect, for whom the memory aspect was really the central reason. They wanted to be a witness to a group of readers about their culture's past. And I don't want to, you know, I don't want to sound too snotty about this at all. There are all sorts of historians from within academia. I think of Jonathan Spence, who writes in Yale about China, Jim McPherson, who writes brilliantly about the Civil War at Princeton. But by and large, you have to really be quite determined to do that. You know, I have small children and I do go around schools a bit trying just simply to be a kind of historical storyteller at the classroom. And I do wish professors talked more to schools. I think the more they talk to schools, the more upset they would be about the kind of textbooks that's being actually fed to their children. Because they seem to me textbooks written by committees for political, you know, adoption purposes, and texts which are almost designed to have the blood and the kind of excitement drained out of them.
So what keeps you in academia? You've given us your critique.
Yeah, well, I'm lucky at Harvard because I do get to sort of teach students in art history. We have a kind of the famously self-designating core curriculum. So I teach students, not just people who are majoring in in history. I do have wonderful colleagues in other disciplines as well as my own. It's an incredible sort of, there's not a day I don't sort of congratulate myself on my undeserved good fortune for being paid to tell stories, for me to sort of stand up as a kind of historical ham actor and sort of, kind of go on about some remote event.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's a pleasure.
Simon Sharma's new novel is Dead Certainties. This is Fresh Air.